Welcome to Primordial Tao, Present Tao, a podcast about all things Taoism. Our conversations and interviews will discuss ancient and modern Taoist wisdom teachings, spiritual practices, seasonal longevity and healing traditions, relationship guidance, and profound insights on walking an authentic and meaningful path, however you choose to walk it. Welcome home to the ocean of Tao.
Now, that doesn't mean you have failed. That does not mean your practice has failed. It means now it's time for sacred intimacy because something's going on you haven't met yet. So shake it off. Maybe go to a sweat or something. Or come back to your practice and go like, okay, Michael keeps reminding me that there's layers and layers and layers. And then it's not about you. It's layers of ancestors, layers of the rest of the planet, layers of the rest of reality. So anytime we get knocked down, we can feel bad. We will. Egos do that. But then we can also go, what's the thing I can do that makes me feel resourced enough in my skill set, my toolbox, to go and find out what this next thing is? Because that's definitively what intimacy means. I am open to the parts of this I have never seen before in you and in myself.
Hello, Primordial Tao, Present Tao audience. This is Dr. Michael Smith, and I just wanted to add a quick little preface to this episode. Because of how personal this conversation tended to get, I've edited out a few places that we went that were just a bit personal. And since I have the microphone to myself, I just thought I would ask if there is specific aspects of Taoist practice, Taoist philosophy, medicine, and other aspects of this ancient tradition that you would be interested in hearing about, as well as what we usually talk about. Feel free to let us know through the comments on this page or through the Primordial Tao, Present Tao page on Facebook. Between part one and part two of this episode, I'm going to share some of the courses I'm offering in 2024, just in case they're of interest to you.
So welcome to Primordial Tao, Present Tao. This is episode 13, The Unexpected Intimacy of Inner Cultivation. I want to give a little bit of context for why we're doing this podcast. And I guess I'm going to be the proverbial lab rat and be, I guess, vulnerable with my experience. And I think it's going to be good.
Well, they do say vulnerable is the new courageous, and I think that's pretty true. Well, let's be courageous then.
Let's be courageous.
I'm down for some courageous. So
I'm beating my chest right now. So a little bit of context on kind of what how this podcast came into fruition. I was kind of going through some stuff last week, and I used my phone a friend lifeline, and my friend's Mike, by the way. So I'm actually going to read this email that I sent Mike, and he actually said, hey, this would be a great podcast. You want to put it out for the world? And I said, sure, why not? Because if I'm going through this, there must be somebody else that's going through this. So here's the email. Hey, Mike, can we do a one-on-one? I've been struggling with my practice. I am now finding my way out of overstimulation, destructive behavior. Yeah, so at this time, I was kind of like deep in my negative patterns, whether it's overstimulation, eating, drinking, sugar, kind of whatever I could do to I guess, comfort seek. I think I'm getting into processing adaptive overwhelm, and I'm getting to consciously go through the memories of my life where I've denied my true self and the ensuing things that have happened in my life and all the suffering that came from that. I assume as we get into these more cognitive parts of deconstructing our identity, I would need to do more things like this. I need some guidance with respect to being prepared for a 49-day practice, or even if I'd be ready for something like this based on what I'm experiencing. Thank you. So yeah, basically, I guess rewind to last week, I was in the chaos, you could say, where it's like couldn't find up, couldn't find down, couldn't find my grounding. I stopped practicing for the first time in years for probably 3 or 4 days. Didn't even want to look at my practice, didn't even want to touch it. And was just I guess comfort seeking. So I stayed away from any pot or anything, which was interesting because that would have usually been my go-to. But it was more food. So it was, yeah, mostly food. Which is very drug-like in a way. So yeah, from that place, I'm kind of smiling today, and so I guess I'm out of it today, so I'm not feeling like that anymore. So I found my grips through that, but I think it's a really good little, I think it'd be a good thing to unpack for everyone.
For sure. Do you have a pen?
Okay, got my pen, got my paper.
Okay, so we're all going to do this together as we record this. So this might be the kind of the least flowing podcast because I think we're going to kind of co-create it as we go through it. And as listeners, I'm just asking you all to try to join us and appreciate that the conversation is that there's no table of contents for what we're going to be doing here. And that's why I asked Rabbi to grab a pen because I'm going to try and spring from what you've said so far. So let's talk about what the word intimacy means, the distinction between cognitive and visceral, why dissociation and trauma and freeze states are very, very tied together, and how addiction is kind of a buzzword in a way, and that I think defining addiction and or compensatory behavior as similar and overlapping, but also uniquely different because of the volume of shame that gets attached to the word addiction. So we're if and I'm glad you wrote that down because I don't have a pen handy. Because we just want to maybe start by, let's say, defining the conversation and the terms and the meanings so that as we go into like the how to be with and maybe what to do or be with, which is the doing part, I guess.
Yeah.
The aspects of this that actually hold the most, I would say, like, how compost becomes soil, soil becomes food.
Yeah.
Cool. So I
Okay,
think
so
the
I
first one on that list was defining intimacy. So very quickly, one thing that I would say most of us choose to kind of focus on when we think of intimacy is either sexuality or secrets or a kind of trust, like there's a special club we're a part of with the people we are allowed to or want to be intimate with. So when it's only about sexuality, then intimacy isn't really about our social, spiritual, maybe even psychological aspects, because when we think of intimacy and sex, most of us are just thinking about really hot, good, kind of unforgettable, wow, a high five and a puddle of sweat kind of sex, right? Or some deep sort of pseudo tantric eye gazing reunion of the masculine and feminine, or two unique beings become one in the ideational sense of intimacy. And I'm not saying those things aren't true. I'm just saying let's begin with the pre-packaged meaning of a word like intimacy, and to recognize that in those two approaches to intimacy, notice that we already have a sense or an image or a projected future memory of what it would be like and what we would remember afterwards. And I know I'm playing with time a little bit trickily here, but try not to get distracted by that.
Yep, got it.
So if intimacy is maybe more than just wow sex, or we're so dissolving into each other sex or making love, again, if those definitions are by definition already defined, notice that nothing new is happening. I mean, we can fantasize about what it might be like breaking through a boundary of something, but that something is already something we expect, right? So intimacy in that sense is, close to something, but I think it's missing something. Because in my experience with, so I would say a few streams and decades of encountering intimacy in a sacred context, in that sense, intimacy is the opportunity to discover something you did not, could not, and probably would never have noticed about yourself or your lover, or understood, or met, or perhaps even faced in some challenging way, an aspect of yourself or your lover, right? So the intimacy in the sacred sense is the space that you can create with, within yourself and another being, and perhaps within creation, creationing as well, for the unknown to arise, be met, be held, maybe be integrated and or dealt with in a way where perhaps what we discovered in intimacy was something we now know about ourselves we don't want to continue. And that's sort of the, say, the yin and yang, left foot, right foot of that sacred aspect of intimacy is I had no idea that I liked or wanted this in my experience. And I'm going to continue seeking that, or oh my God, that's kind of pathological. I'm good to know I have that urge, but I need to reorient myself because that urge is probably pathological. And that's really rare that that happens, but let's include that because we're going to be talking about healing and in the sense of self-intimacy. So if we can redefine intimacy as the willingness, trust, stability, and kind of connection with, self-creation, Tao, other, to face the unexpected, right? And quite often, because in the context of, say, love and intimacy, what comes up is about how to connect with another person in ways we haven't before. So probably 95% of the time, we're just discovering more potent ways to connect. To express, to play rough, to play gentle, to play, however we want to play. Right? And in meditation, it's, the intimacy is now between you and aspects of you that are below mundane cognition, mundane perception, mundane patience or willingness or even willpower to handle. Because in meditation, you're going to face every demon that's already there, and every demon, and I don't mean demons literally, but I mean challenges, that sometimes we just invent to stop ourselves from going into peace, right? Sometimes there are some core issues that are going to come up, and without the stable connection like you would have with a really conscious, long enough term lover to go into those places with, if you don't have an established practice, the space, the groundedness, the patience isn't available. Right. So until we have a grounded practice, the tricky things aren't going to show up. And that's always something that surprises people. I'm really starting to get a sense of momentum in my meditation, and then don't crash, speed bump, fireworks, weird explosion, demon, whatever. How did this happen? Why am I dealing with this stuff now? And it's like, well, now you're ready for this stuff. You would not be experiencing these things peeking through the veil if you weren't ready for them.
So I had a conversation or actually earlier today around and I don't know if we need to go in this direction, but how some of these wounds come from our ancestors, and how a lot of it we're carrying kind of past traumas, unhealed things that maybe our forefathers carried, and now it's kind of our duty to, if we choose to, it's our duty to kind of move through and transcend these things.
Yeah, no, I would say, and I don't know anything about Sikh or Hindu or most things from India, just because I haven't spent enough time learning about that. But say from China, other early traditions, you know, especially say with Chinese Buddhism and Taoism, and to save time, pain is the most effective teacher throughout time and existence. So when whatever contemporary time you're, you know, existing in it, and if you go through all the old literature, the people writing things down were in the now, they were in the future, they were in the first time that we've ever run into this thing. And although they were relying on teachings of the past, they were kind of facing that membrane of from now on we can, you know, we could, we will. So every thing we have that's written down was written down by somebody going, oh my God, or my dog, or my, you know, I don't want to make any references to anything that might get me in trouble here. But what if we all could understand this truth and move forward in this way? So let's say people have been doing that for thousands of generations across the world, experiencing profound, visceral, personal, existential, you know, crisis pain on whatever level, and coming to a place of how to be with that within or by adding something to a tradition. Right. So let's say in this moment, let's all just take a deep breath. No one in the history of time has ever taken this breath at this point on the scale of time. Like we're at the leading edge of consciousness in this moment. Like the light moving through your eyeball right now, right now, right now, right now is the first time in the history of time that this has happened. And we're all leaning into the future that way. And we're all dealing with our response to pain. And we're triggered in our pain to do something about it, which brings up how to do something about it. So we learn from teachers, we learn from books, we learn from YouTube nowadays, you know, our practices and our wisdom and all those things. But we're doing it in exactly the same way people have been doing since they were banging rocks together trying to figure out how to make sparks, right? So when we're in that kind of pain that really goes deep into the instinctual, visceral, you know, sense of self and, you know, can I continue? All of the things that other people have tried, coherently or manically or, you know, however, throughout, say, the last 20 odd generations, that's a, you can read epigenetically and genetically about 22 generations of trauma response now from a clinical point of
Wow.
view. So let's say, you know, at least, you know, 1,000 years or something of people trying to, you know, get it right. Or something. I probably have the math wrong. Somebody's doing math
Well,
faster than I am.
depends on how long people lived, because 50 would make it 1,000, but anything above 50 would make it like.
Okay, so let's say a few 100 years. Anyway, let's get past the
All
math.
right.
if not thousands of generations, right? So when we're past our wits end, which I love that expression in the context of meditation, and we're in pain, we're going to get all kinds of intuitive consciousness memories, race memories, through what's called hunan in Taoist practice. Some of it wise, some of it frantic, some of it what you might call coyote medicine or crazy wisdom. And it's up to us to filter through that, find the nuggets, find the rootedness, the groundedness, and the right relationship, kind of intimacy, acknowledgments that this is probably the way to go. And which is why it usually often takes like a few days to even 2 to 3 weeks when we have a bit of a manic episode or a depressive episode where we're just beyond our wits' end. So the instinctual ancestral stuff comes up. What if I try this? What if I go back to that? What if thing I read about would work? Or we hop from, say, our ancestral cultural roots and paradigm into something we're learning from another culture, like unless you grew up in some part of China where Taoism is the thing, you're really not going to have race memories of how to do it in the Taoist way. But if you're learning about Taoist practice, Xiu Dao, Ta Yin, Nei Gong, Nei Dan, you know, Xian Tai, whatever the handle you're hanging your practices on, which are very distinct in a way, then now you're using a different map, you know, a different compass, but you're navigating the same journey of visceral, existential, instinctual, you know, beyond the capacity to handle kind of pain. And that's where intimacy starts, is I don't know if I can handle this. This is new. And if we have a connection to something, practice, you know, in the intimacy sense of sex, a lover, in the spiritual sacred intimacy sense of maybe lover, maybe, you know, Tao or creation or God, or however you want to think about that. Now intimacy matters because we're sharing the dispositive parts. I'm not going to say negative. I'm just going to say dispositive parts, because pain doesn't really come across that great as a teacher. But it is the number one black belt, most effective one ever. Because why else would we spend so much of our time in practice other than to be beyond the conditioned, mundane wheel of grinding, especially nowadays, colonizing, you know, industrializing, world destroying, you know, kind of pain? Because we need it. We've always needed it. Practice goes back to the beginning of language, so.
Yeah, and we have the unique opportunity now. I think you were saying that we have this unique opportunity now where it's we're not being chased by cats, and we're kind of safe in our homes, and like I got food in my fridge and a job that is pretty relaxed and pays me well, and so I have the op profound opportunity to do this work, which maybe in existence hasn't existed. Especially with all the resources that we have, and I can order all the medicines I need and have all the food I need, especially for my body to heal.
I think people forget that monasteries can only exist within an abundance. And I mean this with a lot of humor. So what I say next is going to sound very weird for most people who are into this stuff. You can only have a monastery when there's enough abundance for a parasitic life form, like a bunch of meditators, to suck off the nipple of abundance. Right. And I'm not saying that because I hate meditators. I'm one of them. I train them. I'm just saying it's a bit of a parasitic thing that needs a lot of extra food, land, safety, time, and protection for a bunch of people to sit in rooms together or alone in silence, maybe, in an environment that's supportive to that, that's not highly confrontive or triggering, so that people can actually kind of dissolve the parts of us that have to deal with bandits and bad guys and bears because you have a basket of food, which has been something that's existed up until whatever your personal culture and ancestry, depending on where you are in the world, had a protective standing army police force that was just as interested in protecting the rich guy in your village as everybody in your village. Right? And that's what 250 years that men and women around the world have had to fight each other with improvised weapons over food on occasion. Right? So how many generations back is having to stab some stranger with your pot stirring stick because they wanted to steal your baby or your wife or your food? Right? So we're all still the kind of humans that were, by necessity, called to show up to those kinds of experiences and then recapitulate them and heal from them. Right. No, I'm aware there's parts of the world that were probably more secure than that 250 years ago, but I'm just sort of throwing down the average of, you know, how agriculture and then kind of the medieval top-down kind of hierarchy of power and then a more egalitarian, organized, protect everybody kind of power came into being. And no, this is not going to be an episode on cultural evolution. It's just to bring our awareness and compassion to what we've had to compensate for.
Yeah, and there's still parts of the world today that are in that stress.
Yeah, and I mean, if the crap hits the proverbial spinny thing, you want to be the fan, Right, that's, I mean, I teach martial arts, so sometimes I say that when the crap hits the fan, be the fan. Right. And that isn't about some hyper violence, hyper masculine tough guy beating your chest thing, which is funny considering what we did 5 minutes ago. But it's recognizing that no matter how challenging life can be, we also have to clean up the mess, the karma, and the existential pain of what we have to do to face those things. A lot of us nowadays are so bored and in the ennui of having to show up in the world that we fantasize about going into violence, going to war for video games, or about going into violent war to kill people you don't know, because it's an instinct to know we can do that. I would love to see those video games just for fun, because my son introduced me to them years ago. Maybe after 4 hours of running around whatever part of the world in the video game, you're shooting a bunch of strangers and some high-end tactical freak show of hyper violence, and everyone else is a bad shot but you. Wouldn't it be really cool if every 4 hours you had to stop and do a warrior healing ceremony or a specialized kind of sweat lodge where you actually had to sing into the microphone of your headset of your video game to heal from all of the harm you had to do, and to grieve the brothers and sisters you've lost beside you in this terrorizing, feeding frenzy of violence. And those games are fun in the sense of run around and develop accuracy and spatial awareness in some way, but we're not aware of, most of us aren't aware of why we're compelled to go and have those experiences, and why we're not dealing with the other side of the experience of, oh my God, I just had to kill whatever number of people. And feel that half of my, team in, say, Call of, what is it, Call of War, Call of Duty, or whatever
Call
those,
of Duty, yeah.
those games are about. Like, why is there never a mopping up of the death, especially of your own teammates,
Right.
right? It cultivates in us a really imbalanced sense of facing the difficulty, facing the initiations, facing the intimacy of dealing with things you didn't expect to find there. Because it just, those kind of games just completely deflect that as if it doesn't even mean anything. Like, why would you ever have to deal with the dead parts, right? So it's very inaccurate to being human.
Wow, yeah, I've never looked at it that way, but totally, and it totally makes sense how we have this I guess culture of avoidance. Like we're just like, no, we're not gonna deal with that.
So that's why I sort of sneaking up on this thing is addiction and compensation are not the same thing. Right? We've always had to compensate for the pain that we experience and bring into the world. Right, compensating for that through ceremony, through, oh my God, I've dissociated because I'm overwhelmed. Now I'm stuffing myself with rice crackers and almond butter or something, with or without weed and with or without tequila or with or without whatever, and that's not the part that matters. What matters is we are capable of going beyond our willingness to be intimate with ourselves, which is in a way a working definition for overwhelm. I do not have the connection, support, tools, culture to deal with the fact I'm this close to being at my wit's end, somatically, viscerally, in my sense of instinct, mojo, jing, in the Chinese medicine sense, to be grounded in this and to navigate my course, my Tao, my way, skillfully. And how else do you develop skills than to go beyond your skill set? Why would we need more skills until we go beyond our skill set? I mean, here's two skills. That's all you'll ever need. Here's yin and yang. Bye-bye. Oh, wait, there's all these other things because we've always needed all of them. When we go
Right.
through the training that I offer people, and I'm not going to go into detail because it would take too long, we deal with a form, I would say, of embodied trauma therapy that was in the family I studied Chinese medicine with. And the sixth kind of boundary we run into, our layer of challenges we face, is a kind of adaptive overwhelm, right? We've fought the good fight. We flinched. We've reacted. We've twitched. We've done the unconscious part. We've tried to control our adaptive choices in some way. We've tried to, deal with our environment in kind of a shock, trauma, stress response. We've dealt with the perception that we're probably not going to be able to keep doing this for very long, which brings up a lot of anxiety, apprehension, and kind of different kinds of fear. Because what if I'm not able to keep this going, or what if I lose it, or whatever? And then we start to tilt into that because we've burned our candle at both ends in the middle, and now we're not experiencing just anxiety, but what if this doesn't go well? We're experiencing directly the organic, visceral, instinctual, animal, and somatic and emotional and existential and spiritual crisis of this is my wit's end on every level of any paradigm you could ever, exist in. And I'm using the Taoist Chinese medicine paradigm, but we could invent a paradigm. We could go to any culture in the world that happens to have a paradigm, and they will have that with the word for, okay, now that this is where you need a healing, you need a mentor, you need an elder, you need a practice, you need time, you need to recognize that this is beyond you. And that's where the real game begins in meditation, is it's never been about you anyway.
Right.
So it's amazing how what I call the cheese grater, because for some reason I use this image, and if you're not watching any video version of this, I'm holding up an invisible cheese grater and rubbing it up down the side of my face, because that's been my experience in life, where life feels like that, or I'll compel the conditions of my life until I feel that, because now I'm in the kind of pain where I need to numb out or go deeper into my practice to find out whether or not I can manage overwhelm. Right. And one funny thing about this from a practical point of view is overwhelm being, say, the sixth sort of layer of challenges in life presumes that we've been using ourselves, our adaptability, our qi, our shen, our qing, to face all of this stuff in ways that didn't work, at least didn't work completely. They got us this far, but now we're in overwhelm. So, oh, well, that map didn't get me where I wanted to go. But when we start to reorient ourselves to not the how we're going to face it, but how we're going to be in this moment, not how we're going to solve the problem, but how we're going to be the one meditating, we start to recover all the energy that was lost in the unconscious responses, the animal responses, the impatient responses, the perhaps aloof, arrogant, oh yeah, I'll just put this over here and it'll go away kind of responses. And then we realize the status quo kind of way of getting through life isn't working, and we relent that, we give that back. All that energy that was lost in misuse is available again to restore us in our overwhelm. But until you have a how to do that, and the willingness to recognize that, and the intimacy of, I don't know how, but I'm willing to lean into practice and to let go of ineffective tools. Now that I'm this far into it, now you develop a whole different kind of skill set. Now, I want to say this. This is kind of like a mini inversion between yin and yang. I'm not talking about the classic, mercury-led, Kan and Li shenanigans of inner work with Taoist cultivation and Nei Kong and Nei Dan at that level. I'm just talking about the mundane, oh my God, I'm past my capacity to deal with things in the world kind of level. But they share a kind of metaphor where the nature of where practice originates and where cultivation is experienced goes somewhere completely different. Because in the context you and I are talking about, how we respond to the outside world and its cheese graters and everything else now goes on the inside, and we seek a different kind of recourse and resource from within. And we reabsorb, you could say, or recapture the flailing attempts on the outside to deal with those things, which is, you could say, a kind of maturity, a kind of, oh my God, there is no way to deal with this superficially anymore.
Yeah, the way that I kind of felt when I was in that experience is like, it's like I reached into my tool belt and like all the tools I had is like, oh no, like I don't have the tool for that. And then ensued flailing, because then I'm like even like getting to stand for practice was like, I don't even know how to get there. I was just, yeah.
So how are we doing with our list of things that you wrote down?
We got the first one.
Okay.
Actually, no, we kind of we're doing pretty good. So we had intimacy. We kind of went into addiction and compulsatory behavior, dissociation, trauma, free states. Where do we go next?
Let's go back to the compensation addiction thing for a sec.
Yeah, let's do that. Because
Mm-hmm.
there's the shame aspect, and I know when we started this conversation, I kind of alluded to that I was using food like an addiction, but now, kind of based on our redefining it, I think it was more compensatory behavior.
Yeah, and that's why I want to come back to this, because I just want to define addiction in the clinical sense of addiction. And it's a there's a lot of overlap between compensatory behavior and addictive behavior, right? If we didn't have compensatory behavior, I think the world would be a very, very dangerous and chaotic and guess I'm thinking of the scary movies when society breaks down and all of the really ragey people just go on a killing spree. Right. So we are capable of that. We in fact have nightmares about it and make movies about it to make real our deepest fear. Right. Because if we could not compensate when people lose it, they lose it all over the place. And we have obviously the history of that. And I think of like in the First Nations context of part of my background, like there's certain beings that we have in our oral histories and stories that are that, you know, people who have turned cannibal or something. Okay, so we can say compensation and a need. We need skills for that. So what is addiction then? Addiction is a compensatory behavior that you will continue to do regardless of its negative consequences to your health, your life, in the sense of say your job or you know family and stuff like that, and the harm it brings to the people around you. Okay. Because an addiction is a compensatory behavior that hurts people, that destroys lives, right? And yet you keep doing it, right? So say alcohol is a great example because it's one of the number one killers of humans, causes of cancer, causes of brain damage, causes of liver damage, causes of all kinds of problems. And those of us who have taken that too far, knowing full well that now we're actually pouring literally a toxin, intoxicant, into the body that has priority enzymes to get that out of you before it kills you, but it just kills you slower now. And yet we keep doing it as we lose friends, as we lose jobs, as we lose lovers, as we lose connection with our children, as, right? So that's the distinction between I need a band-aid and I now need to start hurting people unconsciously around me. Right? And this is where the shame thing is, because you have to ask yourself, and I'm speaking to the listeners and you and myself, we have to ask ourselves, addiction in that context has to have two clear sort of sub-definitions. I'm still aware of what I'm doing and can care, or I'm beyond caring about even being conscious of what I'm doing. Because once you're past being conscious of caring of what you're doing, adding shame to that is a really interesting choice. Hurting yourself, hurting other people, and kind of being snide and sneering, going, I don't care, screw everybody. I would feel some embarrassment and probably a lot of shame about doing that. And I could tell the stories that we could all tell at an AA meeting about those things. But I'm also aware that people go past that to the point where you're actually just killing yourself slowly. That's such a profound place of woundedness that to add shame to that kind of woundedness is like kicking a person who's being eaten by alligators. Because they should have figured out the alligators on their own somehow.
Yeah.
I
And
mean, maybe go ahead. Sorry, go ahead.
a lot of the times we even look at people that are in that state. I'm gonna just reference like the homeless population, and there's a lot of people that look at those people with like disdain of like, Like, oh, they can't just like get a job or like get their life together, and they're just doing drugs, and now they get free needles and all of that.
Yeah, well, why do we have so many people? What was it? 30% of people will experience depression in their lives, sometimes because of loss and sometimes because of exhaustion. Right? We have a culture where probably one fifth of us has some distinct behavioral mechanisms or limits that is not embraced in our educational sort of formational organization of capacity. So, there's that. Then there's 5% of the population is so beyond insane that they're actually fantasizing about how fun it would be to just unleash the alligators on everyone and just watch and eat some popcorn during the frenzy. So let's say, and I'm playing with statistics here, but let's just say it's an easy one quarter of us are not being supported and getting our needs met, and we'll have to behave pathologically in the context of the rest of the population, because the rest of everyone else is just happily, working, shopping, eating, crapping, and paying bills to the degree that we feel like we're succeeding. And in one context, that's true. But in the sense of a tribe, a unified, mature adult population taking care of everyone, we're not even at 75%. Like, that's a B. We're not even getting a really solid B as a culture, because we're leaving a quarter of us behind, some of those people completely psychopathic or sociopathic, and not doing anything about it besides drugging them or imprisoning them. Right. So when we come to shame, I think, we're creating the conditions where one out of four people is going to suffer huge. And so what? They can go live on the street, they can take the drugs, they can go to jail. The rest of us got to shop, eat, poop, and pay bills. So when we want to speak of ethics, which is where shame should come from, or shunning should come from, we kind of suck at that. So maybe let's turn the shame around to the system that creates the conditions for all of this suffering, instead of the people who are left behind and have the treadmills of industrial colonization across their throat and face. And I'm saying that with a certain amount of visceral pain from, over half my family's native. Like, I mean, I'm just reflecting on, like, I'm coming up on 56, and a huge part of my life has been defined by most of my relatives are marginalized people who are left to their own devices after being run over by a tractor, from an alien culture who had zero interest in their well-being, and in fact is kind of still gleefully hoping to destroy them. Right. And I'm sure you've experienced racism in your life coming to Canada and, things like that. So I'm just pointing the flashlight of shame where it actually probably needs to be pointed.
Yeah, I'm sure that hits really close to home with, I know it does with myself, but probably our listeners too. And we're all becoming more aware, I think, the whole thing with that 215 kids in the residential schools.
Well, it's 10,000 now.
I know it's 10, but it started with that number.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's more. I'm sure it's, yeah, I don't even want to know.
Yeah, well, let's not go there, because we're
Yeah.
gonna try and keep this about Taoism, Qigong, and how to take care of you.
Yeah.
But
Yeah.
to just like to like let's just take a
But yeah,
moment
let's
and put
just.
that flashlight down and go, like, okay, now we know where the shame light probably needs to be pointed if we're gonna use it at all. But it's really not a useful tool. It just is designed to make people feel bad to control their behavior. And clearly, that isn't a good idea, because it just produces more addiction.
Yeah, I'm just gonna say, let's just take a moment and feel that.
Yeah.
And 'cause I bet, not I bet, there's probably a lot of our listeners that are listening right now too, just feeling that, and maybe having this opportunity at this very moment to like, kind of unshackle themselves of that shame.
Yeah. Well, let's put the flashlight down together. We don't need a light to point shame at anyone. Right? But notice that that flashlight has put us all into some pretty uncomfortable places.
Yeah, I'm recognizing shame's cousin, blame.
Yep. Yeah. Well, why not have two-fisted flashlights, right? The light in the club.
Okay, so we're making progress here.
So when you were speaking at the beginning of this, you were talking about going into the deeper aspects of Nigong practice, which is sort of preparing for Neidan or kind of, immortal embryo practice in Taoism, and how we're going to need to develop the cognitive skills to deal with the overwhelm. And because
Right.
as we study how to recover our qi and our yin yang, shen qing, to balance things out so we can anchor ourselves in a healthy system, let's say, within our meridians, with our dantian, within our three treasures, our five organs, or all the different, I mean, Chinese medicine had a lot of paradigms to discover and restore balance, right? That paradigm, Chinese medicine, Taoist practice, also goes fairly deep into the psychology part, right? The cognitive part, though, is, and I'm kind of making this up in my mind right now to take us somewhere. The cognitive part is vastly behind the visceral part in time. And when I say vastly, I mean maybe up to 2/10 of a second. And in meditation, 2/10 of a second is eons. So if I'm cognitively sitting there in one context, eons behind the visceral experience of what I'm going through, trying to cognitively understand, maybe find a name, memory, reference point for what I'm feeling, experiencing, to move that reference point of terminology and memories around in a way that allows me to consider, ruminate, associate, reflect on, ideate on what I'm experiencing viscerally, and then maybe develop some kind of way of steering my choices and, navigate my practice in some way towards something that feels like relief or skillful response or right action or something like that. So how do we actually move below the cognitive into the visceral with the visceral? All right. And this is why with working with Dantian or what we call the six minds, the pain bodies and things like that, is somatic, not cognitive. Right, why we play with like how to kind of imitate and play with how we embody our reflexes, how we embody the part of us that's, I call it the garbage can lid on Oscar the Grouch, or the way we repress the intuition and anxiety of the butterflies in our stomach. Right, so if those are a kind of somatic clamping, dissociating, holding back, locking the door, trying to nail it shut or something so we don't feel those things. That state is what makes us compensatory. I do not, cannot, will not feel this. Now there's a cognitive part to it, but what's going on is below cognition. It's just a visceral, right? Like if you say I drop something on my finger, I am now putting my finger as far away from my actual face as I can get it, because I don't want to perceive my pain. And I shake my finger like this, or if I burn my finger on the stove, move it away from perception and make it go away, stick it in your mouth, shake it again, because we're just in a reaction to pain. Now, I don't know if you've ever burned your hand on a stove, but how cognitive was your response?
Not very.
Right? It doesn't matter. It's below the 2/10 of a second threshold of now think. Right. So when we're reacting to reactions and that we have to recognize, hopefully with some humor, please. I hope you're listening to this and finding humor in this. This is below your mind. So maybe learn practices that interact with your experience that are below cognition, below words. Because if you can find a word, it's actually a recognition, not even cognition.
Yeah, as you're talking, it's like the way I was attempting to move through this, it was like I was using a blunt tool when I needed a sharp one.
Or maybe you just needed a hug.
Maybe, yeah.
Right? So this is the thing is when it's about feeling that is visceral, not feeling that is emotional, and this is what we talk sometimes in Dantian practice between lower Dantian, middle Dantian, what it's like to feel your solar plexus just below the diaphragm and feel your solar plexus just as and above the diaphragm. And I mean like millimeters below and above the diaphragm. And I'm saying this as a clinician, kind of doctor professor guy, because I've been in love with understanding the actual neurophysiological, like nerve plexus, celiac plexus, solar plexus, sacral plexus, all those things that we can reference as Dantians, but we can also almost dissect down to the wiring of sense existence. Now, that doesn't give us superpowers. It doesn't give us an answer. It just gives us like a paddle for our canoe to be like, okay, that's really happening. The way I feel a certain kind of visceral agony and ennui or depression and overwhelm below the diaphragm is without words. There's no way to say that. You can moan, you can groan, you could shout, you might be able to sing a certain note in the sense of where certain kinds of singing has to come from to be really emotive. But to be emotive, you have to be primal. The emotive part is how we feel about the primal, because the primal doesn't have like a palette of emotion. It just has ah. And then you move your awareness to just above the diaphragm to where like social intuition and feeling and meaning happen amongst beings, you know, in the sense of say run thy and things like that. Now we're like, okay, now I'm having feeling as emotion. And then a little higher, you're having feeling as sentiment. Like, how do I feel about my feeling? Right. So it's like going down on an elevator. Like I sometimes describe this as landing a helicopter in a storm. Like you're buffeted by the sentiment, and then you okay, that's me feeling my feelings about my feelings. Let's drop into the actual feeling. Okay, that's rage, that's shame. Okay, those are pretty simple words. I mean, I love the four letter emotions because they're four letter emotions. You know, keep it gonna retool how to spell shame. But now I'm just above the real visceral stuff. Can I drop into the real visceral stuff and be like, oh? And I don't know if you're able to join me there, Ravi, or like, obviously, I can't ask the listeners for not doing this live, but like, when you get into there, like, now what?
It's funny because in my head I was just hearing like Sundance or like sweat songs, sweat lodge songs, and
Yeah,
I'm
where do
like,
you
oh
think they
yeah,
come from?
they totally come from there. Because like as I was like even just hearing them in my head, I have a little tiny little knot here, and I was feeling how that would totally break up that aspect.
Yeah, I've been involved in this sweat tradition about 30 years and in supportive role, let's say, for about 15. And people often ask me, what are those songs about? Because, you know, they're thinking like it's a kumbaya, you know, campfire song you sing on the bus with a bunch of kids or something. It's like, no, we're screaming in visceral agony about hoping the universe has some capacity within it that we can only describe as a mystery beyond conception or even possible conception that might hear our pain and respond empathically. Like all we're doing is making as much noise as we can in the hopes, not the knowing, not the negotiation, just the hope that the universe can at least lean towards our well-being, support our overwhelm. Right. So when we go into, say, Dalian practice, therapeutic Qigong practice, we do all the things to deal with the heebie-jeebies, the willies, the overwhelm, right? So we're doing the shaking, the soothing, the rolling, the rhythmic, the hypnagogic things that we can do to soothe the animal body as an animal, not as language. We have breath work that's about state shift and state break, right? We have the healing sounds that I doubt the listeners have, because I don't publish a lot of the stuff that I do. Unless it's, you know, within a certain context. But when you do the, if you ever see the healing sounds, as it's done in the contemporary way, the sounds are made just very like la la la, hoo hoo hoo, he such way, you know, and it's just sort of like, you know, gentle, therapeutic, you know, happy thought kind of sounds. And I don't know, I think you've done that training with me. Where do we take those sounds?
Where the
Yeah, so
pain
we're
is.
going to make the healing sounds for the pain in the organ to express the pain as visceral emotion, not as sentiment.
Right.
Right? So trying to cover up sentiment with happy campfire sentiment is just a band-aid. So we're doing compensatory Qigong, which is better than nothing. But if you want to go below compensatory, then you have to get into the visceral, which is below language, which is why the healing sounds are basically like, ah! But I have yet never seen that outside of closed door, like clinical healing traditions of Qigong. I have never seen in the public domain the healing sounds done viscerally.
Yeah, I have to brush
Right.
up on my healing sounds.
But just on the way, I'm not suggesting that's the way. I'm just saying notice in the context of what we have as a toolbox, even the healing sounds have been watered down to, insipid Kool-Aid sounds, which is better than, nothing. You need a band-aid, you need, like watered down Kool-Aid, then yay. But if you need sweat lodge like potency because it's going back that far in the ancestry of how to deal with life when life is dealing you a rough hand in a lot of ways, like then you need to have rough practice. And
Yeah,
that's not
it's
the answer. That's just the doorway. Now you can move towards the pain because now it's not compensatory. It's definitely light years away from addiction because you're moving towards the problem, even if you have no idea what to do with it when you get there. And maybe there's nothing to do with it. It's just being with it. And this is what we sometimes talk about, embracing pain as if it's in a sacred basket, which is what Dantians can be.
right.
Right, because yeah, the sacred and the intimacy is I have no idea what will arise, but I have practice, I have tools, I have lover, I have this to find out what will arise from the unknowable in the passion of life. It's funny thing, compassion doesn't have anything to do with passion. It means to feel the suffering as if it's yourself, which is spiritual intimacy. Because can I actually hold my ground, keep my keel in the water as I open the lid to all of the visceral agony of all my ancestors? I don't know if I was talking to you a couple of years ago. I was talking to someone and we're getting into meditation, and I think it was you, so that's why I'm bringing this up. I had said, well, the next thing is, does you feel all the pain in the world right now? It's only 8 billion people. And then it's to feel the pain of the world over time. And then if you really want to just dive right in, it's to feel all pain of all beings, sentient across all universes, all dimensions, and multiverses, just in case that's a thing. Because until it's yes to it all, you're negotiating and compensating.
I guess I got about 25 years to work on that
Or you just say, yes, I
project.
will find the beyond selfness. Because if you think one individuated modern human can handle all of that as an egoic identity, that's actually why I bring it up, is this has to be allowed to be beyond the separate self. Because that's the pain. The pain is the separation.
Right. Because, yeah, I guess pain that would, the way I look at it is like, yeah, pain that big would make your head explode, but that's welcome to non-separation.
So I just had this flash of an image, and I'm going to share it just because it might help. And for those of the listeners who may not be familiar with what a sweat lodge is, imagine it's a sacred kind of sauna. And imagine, and I want to see this happen now in some version of the universe, where every house has a sauna next to the bathroom or something, where we go into it, and now you're in a virtual ceremonial environment where you're connected to everyone else on Earth. Let's just keep it to Earth and the year it is. And you're all in there because you're in the pain room. And anytime for the rest of our lives, let's imagine there's a room in every house, maybe in every shopping mall next to the bathrooms, where you can go in there, sit, and be in some kind of virtual witness to the, let's say, billion people who are in that room in their house, in wherever they are in the world. Singing or praying or chanting or yawning or doing breath work or meditating or hopefully doing something helpful. And what would life be like if we all had a room in our house that since childhood we've been in to cry, to have a tantrum, to have a freak out, to find solace in when we're dissociating, to find other ways to compensate for pain before it turns into addiction? Like, wouldn't that be an interesting world? And that metaphoric sauna sweat lodge room is practice. Right? Now, a lot of us at times can't get into that room because we got hit by something that knocked us down before we could get to the room or begin our practice. Now, that doesn't mean you have failed. That does not mean your practice has failed. It means now it's time for sacred intimacy because something's going on you haven't met yet. So shake it off, maybe go to a sweat or something, or come back to your practice and go like, okay, Michael keeps reminding me that there's layers and layers and layers, and then it's not about you. It's layers of ancestors, layers of the rest of the planet, layers of the rest of reality. So anytime we get knocked down, we can feel bad. We will. Egos do that. But then we can also go, what's the thing I can do that makes me feel resourced enough in my skill set, my toolbox, to go and find out what this next thing is? Because that's definitively what intimacy means. I am open to the parts of this I have never seen before in you and in myself.
In the spirit of patience, let's take a short intermission.
I hope this conversation on intimacy and inner cultivation is inspiring for you. I would like to just take a moment and introduce you to some of the courses that I'm offering in 2024, because there's quite a few. The first is called Beginning Your Qigong Healing Journey. It's 10 weeks, and it's based on the book that will soon be out, based on the same name. The second is the 49 Days of Embodied Spiritual Practice. This is a daily live interactive course that begins on March the 18th and will happen every day at about 7:30 in the morning Pacific Standard Time or 10:30 in the morning Eastern Standard Time for, again, every day for 7 weeks or 49 days. I'll be teaching some of the classes every day. There will also be a yoga teacher sharing some yoga and six other mentors from various backgrounds and traditions that will also take part in the course to offer you a very well-rounded experience on a 49-day rite of passage of meditation, breath work, wisdom teachings, standing and seated embodied practices like Qigong and yoga, and some primal movement principles, some agility movements, and some basic resistance training. There will also be a chance for a live Q&A every day. So if you're interested in that kind of interaction, that kind of daily practice, that kind of commitment, and that kind of rite of passage, please let me know. Another course is called Tai Chi Shabasher Qigong, which is an 18-movement form of Qigong based on Yang-style Tai Chi gestures. This will also go for 10 weeks. It's beginning March the 26th. And we'll go into three different levels or passes for each exercise. And besides the basic Tai Chi gestures, we'll speak to the martial arts applications, the breath work, the footwork, and some deeper approaches and principles of Tai Chi to this form of Qigong. I would encourage you to consider taking this course because it's going to take you much deeper into Tai Chi principles, martial arts practice, breath work, stances and structure, and a bit more dynamic agility. Starting again on March 26th is the infamous, in some parts of the world, cleanse course that I do every spring. It's 8 weeks, and we go through every system and organ in your body, talk about how it works, what goes wrong, and what you can do about it with respect to food, mindfulness, exercise, and other aspects of what's called Yang Sheng Fa, or nourishing life principles from traditional Chinese medicine. And because I also practice functional medicine, I'll be throwing in quite a bit of Western physiology that pairs up with what Chinese medicine has to say about what works and why. We are living through a bit of a modern health crisis, and there's many reasons for that. So I would encourage you, if you're trying to improve your health, or if you're a clinician and want a really well-rounded approach to the big picture of either improving your health or preventing yourself from getting a disease, this course would be a good idea. Beginning on April 8th is the 200-hour teacher training program for the Soma Dao Qigong system. This is a one-year program. It covers three levels, and I would suggest that is the most well-rounded and thorough Qigong teacher training program you can get to online. There's two other phases afterwards that would help you get certified to become a professional Qigong teacher, or even to the degree of being a medical Qigong therapist. So I would really encourage you, if you want to teach Qigong and connect with a group of people that are able to take you as far as you could possibly want to go on your Qigong journey, or your Taoist inner cultivation journey, then this would be a good place to start. I will also be offering a 10-month therapeutic Qigong healing journey, And this is primarily for Qigong teachers, acupuncturists, massage therapists, yoga teachers, and other people who work with the general public who want to have a much better sense of how to handle people who've experienced a lot of trauma, the kinds of practices that are best for them, the best approaches to rehabilitate people from chronic illness or injury, and many other aspects of Qigong that have to do with resolving health conditions and or mental or emotional challenges. This course begins June the 4th and again goes for 10 months. Once again, we are offering the Shaolin Strength and Longevity Qigong, or the I Ching Jing. It'll be starting on April the 10th and it will go for 8 months. And it goes through the three contemporary forms. I wouldn't call them all classics because they're not all that old, but they're all used for ensuring you have what's called fascial tensegrity, or balanced tone and pliability across all of your tissues, especially your fascia, throughout your whole body. And that process in itself is beyond description for how good it is for you and your longevity. Then there's the practices that have a lot to do with isometric isotonic training, which can sometimes be trained in the iron body traditions, and quite often were trained by monastic monks to ensure their bodies were health, fit, and strong enough to sit in meditation for many hours a day. And finally, this practice goes into not only the muscle tendon transformation practices or the complete tensegrity trap practices, but also the bone marrow washing, which is a great invitation for people who want to go deeper into meditation, especially in the more esoteric Taoist practices, as well as those seeking longevity and or recovery from any kind of chronic illness. So again, this is starting on April the 10th and will go for 8 months. So that's a basic introduction to some of the courses that are coming up in 2024. There's a few more happening early summer and into the fall, which I'll bring up later. Thank you for your attention and have a great day.
When you are ready for part two, tap the link below.